saying, never engage anyone's arguments, ever. Just check their tribe. And if they're in the wrong tribe, they're just wrong. And anyone who ever disagrees with me is the wrong tribe. That's what the president is saying here when he says Obama judge, for example. Do the judges that you cover routinely say, well, listen, I got to go with my tribe on this ruling?
Well, I think that upset Roberts. You know, if you looked at the president's whole statement, he was suggesting that when we get to the Supreme Court, we're going to get the ruling that I wanted. And suggesting perhaps because there are five Republican appointees on the court. And I think that also probably troubled Roberts, the idea that because we're all Republican appointees here, there are five of them, we're going to vote for the president. You know, there's a difference between having a conservative judicial philosophy and being politicized and necessarily voting for the president just because you may be, sort of share conservative views.
Okay. Amy Howe, thanks so much. Good talking with you.
Good to talk to you, too. Thanks for having me.
She covers the Supreme Court for her blog, Howe on the Court.
The war in Yemen is now in its third year. The U.S. has been supporting the Saudi-led airstrikes there. Experts say the conflict has driven that country to the brink of famine. And in new reports, they are warning that thousands of people, mostly children, are already dying of starvation. NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports.
A doctor weighs a baby in a hospital room filled with emaciated infant patients. The children in this video posted online are living skeletons. You can count every rib. This is the new reality in Yemen. The charity Save the Children now say that some 85,000 infants under the age of five may have died from hunger or disease since the war there began in 2015. United Nations statistics also contain a grim warning. Over 400,000 children will suffer from acute malnutrition by the end of this year. Videos posted by locals on YouTube show the war around Hodeida, a city whose port is Yemen's lifeline for supplies. The fighting is between the government, backed by Saudi Arabia, and Houthi rebels, helped by Iran. Saudi blockades limit essential food imports, and mines planted by Houthi rebels prevent distribution. Save the Children said that for every child killed by bombs and bullets, dozens are starving to death, and it's entirely preventable. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Beirut.
Now we have a story of what can go wrong when you fall in love. In India, parents have a big say in who their kids marry. When a child's heart tugs them another way, particularly towards someone of a different caste or a different religion, it can lead to violence. NPR's Lauren Freyer has this story of one couple who had to escape.
See, we actually met at the working place, and then we started meeting each other, and then we fall in love with each other.
Somil Shah says it was at an electronics store where they both worked 3 years ago that he first laid eyes on the woman who would become his wife. Somil was just back from doing an MBA in England. Zarina had earned a computer science degree. They flirted at work. Zarina is shy and soft-spoken, but she says she knew right away.
I feel good with him. I'm very happy with him.
And the future?
Very bright.
Somil and Zarina just got married, but there was no big wedding. They eloped far from home, and they didn't tell their families. They couldn't. Zarina's family is Muslim, and Somil's is Jain, one of India's smaller faiths. This marriage was forbidden by both families.
Her parents didn't agree with this, and the same with my parents, just because of the religion.
They pleaded with their parents. They're 31 and 26. They're not teenagers. They're educated. They thought this through. But when Zarina's family arranged a marriage for her to a Muslim man instead, she and Somil decided to escape.
Her brother is working at the airport, so we had to decide a day where her brother has off, and we had to run away the night, about 2:30, I guess.
Were you scared?
We were actually scared, yes, because anyone could catch us.
They both still lived at home. Zarina's parents were suspicious. She pretended to be asleep when they peeked into her room at 2 a.m. Then Somil pulled up in a taxi outside. It was now or never, Zarina recalls.
My
parents are nice people, but I wanted to marry for love. They were forcing me to marry someone else. It would have ruined his life and mine. But I still love my parents.
She doesn't know if she'll ever see them again. Zarina tiptoed out of the house she grew up in. She scaled a locked gate out front, tossed out her phone, and escaped with her beloved to a city neither had ever visited, the Indian capital, New Delhi. where I met them, in a safe house run by a group that calls itself the Love Commandos. It helps interfaith and intercaste couples elope and hide from their families. They've got 500 shelters across India.
Here we have a metal detector.
Checking to see if I've come in with weapons.
Yeah.
The Love Commandos founder, Sanjoy Sachdev, scans me for weapons. He made me promise not to reveal exactly where we are. He says he gets threatening phone calls every day from the parents of those he helps. Love couples, he calls them.
Now these parents watch movies full of love stories. When a love couple is separated, they feel sad. But when their daughter is in love, they beat and even kill.
In the southern city of Hyderabad, police say a father recently hired a hitman to hack to death his son-in-law in the street, his pregnant wife beside him. Theirs had been an intercaste marriage. India only started keeping track of such killings in 2014. The most recent statistics show 71 such murders in India per year. But activists say there are thousands of mysterious accidents. And for every young lover killed, there are dozens who face harassment by their families. Women often get it worse, Sachdev says.
Females are more beaten. Their education is stopped, their employment is stopped, their movement is stopped, telephones are snatched, they are forced to marry anybody else, and then they have to escape.
For the past 6 weeks, Somal and Zarina have been staying night and day in a windowless room with three other couples in their same situation. The Love Commandos help them arrange religious conversions, weddings, restraining orders, and airline tickets to start a new life far away. It's like the witness protection program for newlyweds. But it's not the only option for couples in this predicament. In southern India, they're using technology. There's a smartphone app called Kadal Aran, which means protecting love in the local Tamil language. Vasumathi Vasanthi designed this app, which aims to help couples who want to marry outside of Hinduism's often rigid caste system.
Whenever people need any help, they want to go to the police station, but they have the fear to go to police station. They can just download the app and that's it. We will be there to help you.
The app pings a network of volunteers who connect the couple with lawyers, police, or counselors. Technology is also how some of these couples meet in the first place. In the old days, Indians didn't socialize much outside their faith or caste. Now there's social media.
I think the numbers are increasing now.
The exposure to phone and...
I think they're coming out, they're studying together. I think more girls are going for higher education.
Ranu Kulshrestha and her husband, Asif Iqbal, are an interfaith couple who run a support group for people like them. It's called Danak, Rainbow in Hindi.
We get, on an average, 50 SOS calls for help within a day.
In fact, when I arrived at their office, Iqbal was on the phone with a client who's threatening suicide. They counsel couples on what happens after they escape, after the wedding, when happily ever after means reconciling their differences.
You discuss things like, what will be the religion of the children? Sustaining the marriage, even when they find difficulty in getting a house.
Lots of landlords in India will not rent to interfaith or intercaste couples. Weeks after I met Somal and Zarina in the Love Commandos safe house, I got a text from Somal. They're out. They've moved to Mumbai and managed to rent an apartment, their first home together, alone. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, Delhi.
I'm a big fan of loving you. I'm a big fan.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's 8:19 right now. Ahead on the program, Steve Inskeep talks to Angelo Gizaido, a staff lawyer with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who represents migrants seeking asylum in the U.S. We'll hear about the latest court rulings and implications for asylum seekers in about 15 minutes.
I love everything about BBC NewsHour. I love that it takes us to stories that American news organizations don't always cover. I love the international perspectives that the BBC NewsHour gives us. It's a way for us to see what's happening in other parts of the world, but it's also a way we might see what may be coming to our part of the world at the same time.
Get perspective on your world with international news coverage on the BBC NewsHour with Brady Carlson, weekdays at 3 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from Square Wine Company on the Capitol Square, dedicated to selling wines crafted by small family growers who make wines that reflect a sense of place. Holiday gift ideas at squarewineco.com.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Old House Funeral Home. The staff at Piasecki Old House can answer questions about planning a meaningful funeral or tribute service. They consider it an honor to serve families in our community since 1931.
Our weather, partly to mostly cloudy today. There might be some patchy freezing drizzle or snow flurries in the north. Breezy, highs in the mid-30s. Friday, increasing clouds, rain showers possible in the afternoon and evening, highs in the mid-40s. Saturday, cloudy with some morning rain or snow showers possible and highs in the low to mid-40s. And on Sunday, snow, possibly mixed with rain, and some areas could see up to 6 inches of snow, highs in the mid-30s to mid-40s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, committed to offering a streamlined shopping experience where home and auto can be bundled together. Now that's Progressive. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From the Department of Homeland Security with E-Verify, dedicated to providing employment eligibility verification for all businesses and the employees that help them thrive at everify.gov/go. From the YMCA, committed to opportunities for all and the belief that no one should be defined by the zip code they're born into. Details on the impact of donations is at ymca.net/forabetterus. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. The Camp Fire in Northern California incinerated entire towns. More than 13,000 single-family homes were destroyed in the blaze. That's according to the latest reports from California fire officials. Residents who evacuated have not yet been allowed back in. So it's very strange for those who never left. In the community of Concow, a handful of residents stayed behind, including 59-year-old Jeff Evans and his parents who live with him. Evans told me his house survived unscathed, but his neighbors were not so lucky.
Beyond the scope of my property here, when I drive out my driveway, it's like driving on the face of the moon. It's just unbelievable, you know, devastation. But from my house right here, as I stand in my yard, you can't even tell there was a fire.
Really?
But if you go an eighth of a mile up my road, it is absolutely and utterly decimated. There's nothing there. And it's all very dark gray and bleak. I mean, yesterday I was up on a tall bluff, and for as far as the eye can see, 10 miles, there's just nothing there.
Wow. Can you take us back, Jeff, to the morning of the fire and your decision, along with your elderly parents, not to evacuate?
Well, the decision was kind of made for us. I went out in the early morning hours, just like I do most mornings. It's dark. And I stepped into the backyard and I could smell smoke. And I could see the orange glow over to my east on the other side of my neighboring property. And that's when I realized the smoke was incredibly thick. So I helped Mom pack some things. I got all of my computer equipment in my truck. And Dad got it all in his car, and he drove up the road while I was helping Mom. He wanted to see what it looked like, and he came back some minute or two later. He says, there is just no possible way that we are leaving to go anywhere. He said, there's no way you're going to drive through flames like that.
Wow.
So Dad came back here, informed us of that. I called all the neighbors while he was up there, and so those that might have been asleep were awake now. And then Fred, my neighbor up the end of my driveway, got on his big John Deere, and he started cutting fire lines. And my neighbor to the east of me got onto his tractor and another John Deere, and he started cutting fire lines.
And when you say fire lines, you just mean just taking out all the vegetation?
Take out all the vegetation. Get it down to dirt where the fire simply isn't going to burn anymore. That's the only way, really, to shut it down. That's why they have bulldozers out on fire lines. And kind of hard to express, really, in words, but the winds were blowing so hard, you know, that you're running to hit spot fires all over your property.
When did you know that you were safe?
The next day. Actually, no, that's not so. That evening. In fact, that evening, I took a ride up the road, up Hoffman Road, and there were five cars parked in the middle of the road, and that struck me so odd that why would they park their car in the middle of the road and there's no people? So I got out of my truck, and I looked into one of the windows of one of the vehicles, and there's two puppies in the car. And so I grabbed the dogs. I put them in my truck. I went to the next vehicle, and it's like every vehicle had one or two dogs in it. One of them had like six dogs. And I feel so fortunate that I drove up the road at that moment, or those dogs would have died. I'm fairly confident.
So you realized that you and your parents were safe. Your house was going to be spared, and you had now rescued these dogs, taken them back home with you. But who else was there? I mean, you mentioned a couple of other neighbors had stayed.
Yeah, these are all 5 and 10 acre parcels. So there's a bit of distance between homes.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got Joe Wilkins, Fred and Sally Hug, and Stephen Virginia Wildblood. They live just over the hill from me. And it was just us. And there was a couple of people I didn't recognize that were out there fighting the fire, too. I don't know where they came from. Don't know who they were. They might have been visiting some of my neighbors, but, well, I've never asked the questions. I've been a little bit busy.
Busy, you know? Right. Do you guys have enough food? Do you have clean water?
Well, we're operating on generator power, which takes gasoline to run in my particular case. And I've gotten emails from people from Portland to Sacramento that live here that had to evacuate. And they're emailing me instructions on how to break into their house without actually breaking anything.
Huh.
Just so that I can rob their pantry and take their gas and their propane. Incredible people. Incredible people. Huh. Yeah, one case, I got an email last night, and he says, hey, I saw one of the pictures you took of my house that doesn't exist anymore. And he says, and I noticed in the picture there's a red gas can on the side of my small trailer. It's full of gas. It's yours. But what I didn't have the heart to tell him was I took the picture, and then I stole the gas can.
You'd already done it.
Yeah, I'd already done it because I got to survive.
Right.
Plus, the conditions for me changed when I inherited 11 dogs. So now I can't leave. I mean, I have the ability to leave. I can go out, but then I can't come back. They mm-hmm. won't let you pass the roadblocks again. And by that point, the conditions of my world change pretty dramatically.
Right.
I can't leave with 11 dogs. So I stayed here.
So you've got a lot going on and a lot of responsibilities, and yet it is Thanksgiving. Is there a particular way you're going to mark it?
You know, that's a good question. And somebody asked me that yesterday, and I hadn't really entertained that thought. I did this morning. I was talking to Mom and Dad, and we're not going anywhere. So our Thanksgiving is just going to be doing the things I'm doing right now every day.
Mm-hmm.
That's not as depressing of an idea as it might seem.
Mm-hmm.
I know Thanksgiving is a big deal, but my conditions of life have changed, and this is where I am, and that's what I have available to me. And so I'm just going to keep doing what I do.
Jeff Evans in Concow, California. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, certainly my pleasure. Thank you very much.
This is NPR News.
This Thanksgiving, we'll hear from one musician about a hero who changed her career.
He gave me a chance on a huge platform that not many people would think to give someone like me.
Shoshana Bean kicks off our annual chain of musical gratitude. I'm Ari Shapiro, four artists who are thankful for each other. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Brady Carlson is your host for All Things Considered. You can hear it from 4 to 6:30 here on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:29 right now. The latest news from NPR is up next. And in WPR News, Hope Kerwin has a report on what the elements of today's Thanksgiving dinner are costing this year in the state. Details of that story and more on the way.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Search teams in Northern California are spending the Thanksgiving holiday looking for more victims of the campfire. The remains of two people were found yesterday, raising the official death toll to 83. NPR's Bobby Allen says more than 500 people are still listed as missing.
The burn area in Paradise is around 240 square miles. That's about the size of El Paso, Texas. Emergency crews are hoping they can identify the remains of some of the hundreds still missing. But with heavy rain in the forecast, searchers are also bracing for potential mudslides and flash flooding.
The campfire is California's deadliest and most destructive on record. The number of homes and other structures lost to the flames now tops 18,000. A U.S. Border Patrol agent has been found not guilty of involuntary manslaughter by a jury in Arizona 6 years after he shot and killed a teenager in Mexico through a border fence. Attorneys for Lonnie Swartz say the agent fired at the 16-year-old in self-defense to protect himself and other agents from rocks being thrown. The teen was shot 10 times in the head and back. Anna Adlerstein with member station KJZC says the boy's family is looking at its legal options.
There is a civil case pending, and it's on hold until the Supreme Court decides whether the family has a right to sue because he was killed in Mexico.
This is NPR News from Washington.
This is news from Wisconsin Public Radio, 8:31 now. I'm Melissa Ingalls. Several Thanksgiving food items produced in Wisconsin cost less this year. As Hope Kerwin reports, an annual survey of food prices found cranberries and milk saw slight price declines from 2017.
The Wisconsin Farm Bureau surveys grocery store prices to find the average cost of a Thanksgiving dinner for 10 people. This year, the cost was just over $45, more than $2 less than in 2017. Farm Bureau spokeswoman Sarah Hetke says milk prices were part of that decline, with a gallon of milk costing 52 cents less than last year. She says there continues to be an abundance of milk weighing down the world market.
Another reason is a lot of stores will use milk as what they call a loss leader. So they mark that price down, trying to get foot traffic into their store.
Cranberry prices were down about 4% from 2017. Hetke says those prices have been more insulated from overproduction because cranberry producers asked for federal limits on how much fruit can go to market this year. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Foxconn is looking to cut $2.88 billion in expenses in 2019. Bloomberg reports that an internal memo says the company is facing, quote, a very difficult and competitive year. The Taiwan-based producer issued a statement saying it is conducting its usual annual review in order to make budget plans for the coming year. The company is Apple's biggest iPhone assembler and is concerned that demand for popular Apple products is down. Bloomberg reports that the company plans to eliminate about 10% of non-technical staff as a cost-cutting measure. Foxconn is currently building a flat-screen campus in Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin. Critics have questioned the state's commitment to provide up to $4.5 billion in state and local tax incentives to help the company. Opponents also worry about the environmental effects of the 20-million-square-foot campus, which will withdraw several million gallons of water a day from Lake Michigan. Last week, Foxconn posted a weaker-than-expected rise in quarterly profits. And Governor-elect Tony Evers says he might try to end a federal waiver requiring some Medicaid recipients to work for their benefits. Federal officials in October granted Republican Governor Scott Walker a waiver allowing the state to require healthy, childless adults to work to receive health insurance through the Badger Care Plus program. This is news from WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Harvard Business School Executive Education. For executives at any career stage to prepare for new challenges through one of its comprehensive leadership programs. Learn more at hbs.me/executive. From Campaign Monitor, an email marketing platform used by more than 200,000 customers worldwide, with email templates, a drag-and-drop email editor, and 24/7 customer service. More at campaignmonitor.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Behind the latest of President Trump's arguments lies the prospects and futures of thousands of people. His argument is with Chief Justice John Roberts. The head of the Supreme Court rebuked the president for saying that judges were biased based on who appointed them. The president was making claims of bias after a judge did not rule his way, blocking plans to limit who can apply for asylum. That's the case where real people's lives are at stake. The administration wants to reject all asylum seekers unless they go to legal border crossings. Well, what happens when asylum seekers do that? Angelo Gassato is a lawyer for some of those seeking asylum. He's with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
What kinds of people has your organization been representing?
Asylum seekers coming from Central America and Mexico who, due to the United States' policies, have refused them entry into the United States seeking access to the asylum process.
These are people who got to Tijuana perhaps after a journey of several thousand miles from Central America, the kind of people who've been much publicized in that caravan from a few weeks ago.
That's right, and there have been multiple caravans, and it's hard to overstate just the absolute danger and violence these people fled from in their home countries and encountered on the way up to the border.
But then they get to Tijuana, which is a fairly large city on the Mexican border, and there's a large U.S. border crossing. What has been happening over time when they go to that border crossing and apply for asylum?
For the past two or three years, the United States government has, using different methods, rejected individuals who have asked for asylum. In recent months, the government has coordinated with Mexican immigration officials and Mexican NGOs to meet out or perform some sort of wait list where an asylum seeker's have to wait 6 weeks, 2 months in order to access the asylum process.
So what does that mean in daily practice? If someone has come from, say, Guatemala or Honduras, and they go to that border crossing and they say, I'm from Honduras, I would like to seek asylum, what exactly are they being told?
Steve, I'm not sure if I can swear on this program, but one individual from Honduras was just told, Honduras, and was turned away 2 days in a row. Realistically, individuals who present at Tijuana are turned away, directed towards Mexican immigration. They then have to put their names on an asylum wait list before they're even able to apply.
Okay, so when the people are turned away, are they told, we will never let you into the United States, you're not allowed into the United States, or are they told, we've taken all the asylum seekers we can today, please come back at another time?
Both are correct, actually, and it depends on the specific port of entry.
Is that legal?
No, it's not. The INA is very clear that if an individual presents at a port of entry asking for asylum, they have the right, the immediate right, to gain access to it.
So this becomes relevant to the argument about the Trump administration telling asylum seekers to go to a legal border crossing, which on the surface sounds perfectly reasonable. There's a process. Follow the process. Would you contend that the legal border crossings are in any way an open door for at least some asylum seekers?
Not by any measure. Having been to six or seven ports of entry myself, I've seen with my own two eyes people turned away at ports of entry repeatedly. It's no wonder then that individuals are actually forced to cross, quote unquote, unlawfully. That too is protected under the INA, and they're able to apply for asylum both ways.
The Immigration and Naturalization Act, that's the INA, right?
Yes.
So what is happening to these other people who've stayed in Tijuana? They're trying to work the legal process, and they've been told, get started on this, get on the wait list, don't know how long it's going to be. What's happening to them?
It's an unsustainable system. The United States and Mexico know this. What we've seen happen is hundreds, potentially thousands of individuals in Tijuana are stranded in makeshift encampments, staying in an area known as Azteca. These people are sick, tired, and it's severely at risk of very dangerous scenarios with the cartels.
What do you mean by the cartels?
Border towns along the U.S.-Mexico border are increasingly at risk of cartels and gangs who prey upon migrants, the most vulnerable people, for extortion, kidnapping, rape, and assault. And some of my clients and many of my witnesses have been assaulted and or raped while attempting to present at a port of entry.
They've told you that?
Yes.
Let me raise a couple of other things that people ask about these refugees moving north. The first one being, aren't lots of them actually economic migrants?
Some of them may be, yes, but I haven't encountered any, actually.
When you have met people, they have all had stories that sound credible to you of serious fear of persecution or death?
Every single person I have met was either tortured, beaten, raped, assaulted, and either went to the police or the government who had no response or refused to respond, or it was so common that they knew that the government would do nothing, that they had no choice but to flee for their lives.
Angelo Guisado is a lawyer for the Center for Constitutional Rights. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
We're now going to look back at the life of Olivia Hooker. She has died at the age of 103. If you don't know her name, we're going to share some of her story and one important chapter in particular. Olivia Hooker witnessed the Tulsa race riot of 1921.
It was May 31st, 1921. At first, we saw a bunch of men with those big pine torches come through the backyard.
Hooker was only 6 years old at the time. The attack on black areas of Tulsa turned into a massacre. She told her story to the Radio Diaries series earlier this year.
I remember our mother put us under the table. She took the longest tablecloth she had to cover four children and told us not to say a word. It was a horrifying thing for a little girl that's only 6 years old.
White men entered that home, took an axe to the piano, and then left. In the predominantly African-American middle-class neighborhood of Greenwood in Tulsa, hundreds of people were killed. More than 1,000 homes and businesses, including Hooker's father's store, were destroyed.
I guess the most shocking thing was seeing people to whom you had never done anything to irritate, who just took it upon themselves to destroy your property because they didn't want you to have those things. And they were teaching you a lesson. Those were all new ideas to me.
Olivia Hooker's family soon left Tulsa. She said her parents encouraged her and her siblings not to look back, but to look forward. Hooker went on to become the first African-American woman to join the U.S. Coast Guard in 1945. This is NPR News.
Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on the program, Rachel Martin and poet and NPR contributor Kwame Alexander reflect on what people are thankful for with poetry. That's in about 9 minutes here on WPR.
Wisconsin Public Radio and Holiday Vacations present a tour of Hong Kong and Vietnam in March. We'll be taking in rich culture, fascinating history, and beautiful scenery, including a Hong Kong city tour, a water puppet show, and the Ha Long Bay cruise. The trip includes a private dinner at the home of former U.S. Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge. Accommodations and 22 meals are included in this holiday vacations and WPR adventure to Vietnam and Hong Kong, March 7th through 19th. Details at WPR.org/travel.
Support for WPR comes from Destination Kohler in Kohler, Wisconsin, where new multi-bedroom suites can host family gatherings up to eight. More about visiting the American Club Resort, celebrating its 100th year, is at DestinationKohler.com.
Support for WGTD comes from the Studio of Classical Dance Arts, presenting the story of the Nutcracker December 15th and 16th at the Rita on the UW Parkside campus, featuring 69 dancers and over 150 costumes. Tickets and info at classicaldancearts.com.
It's 8:44. Morning Edition is almost over for the day, but we have lots of music for your Thanksgiving. Starting at 9, Stephanie Elkins brings you meaningful American music, starting with The Harvest Home Suite by Jay Unger, who's famous for Ken Burns documentary soundtracks. Between 10 and 12, we'll hear from Wisconsin youth, excerpts from the state honors concerts, along with Mark O'Connor's Johnny Appleseed Suite. And at 1, it's Giving Thanks with John Burge, who welcomes choral music icon John Rutter. Music for your Thanksgiving, starting just after 9, here on WPR. Partly to mostly cloudy today. Some patchy freezing drizzle or snow flurries possible in the northern half of the state, and highs in the mid-30s.
hardly be.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Ancestry, supporting the Great Thanksgiving Listen and StoryCorps' mission to encourage people to explore, share, and preserve their family stories together this holiday season. Learn more at Ancestry.com/NPR. From the Zimmel Family Foundation, supporting Shatterproof, a national nonprofit dedicated to ending the devastation of addiction and transforming treatment in America. Learn more at Shatterproof.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. There are Trump hotels, Trump golf courses. Why not a Trump military base? The government of Poland says if the United States will open a base in their country, they will call it Fort Trump. Polish officials are offering to contribute up to $2 billion to build Fort Trump, saying they need it to keep Russian aggression in check. Here's NPR's Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson.
Poland's role in protecting NATO's eastern flank has grown since Russia annexed Crimea back in 2014. The Polish military posted this video of a NATO exercise there last week called Anaconda, in which more than 12,000 Polish troops took part. Tomasz Rzadkowski, who is an undersecretary in the Polish Defense Ministry, says he's proud of such joint efforts.
Certainly it has contributed to the deterrence. It sent an important political signal, also a strategic signal.
That signal is aimed at Russia, which from its heavily armed enclave of Kaliningrad shares a 144-mile-long border with Poland. But Rzadkowski believes exercises and rotations of a few thousand U.S. and NATO troops on Polish soil aren't enough to keep Russian forces from launching an attack.
Numbers are certainly not sufficient to mount any significant defense. We want to look beyond some temporary measures that were put in place.
What he and others in his government want is for the U.S. to formally open a base in Poland, which could house not only a larger number of troops, but more American equipment and armored vehicles. Exactly where such a base would be located isn't clear, although one likely site is about 80 miles from the Russian border. It's an area where U.S. troops are already training and working with their Polish counterparts. The biggest town here is Osisch, where several restaurants and the office of Mayor Zbigniew Wodkowski have U.S. flags on display. He says U.S. troops provide an economic boost to his community, as do the tourists who come here to watch military exercises or snap selfies with the foreign soldiers. The mayor adds he would welcome a Fort Trump being built here. He says the town's long history as a Polish military hub means much of the infrastructure and local mindset needed to accommodate an American base is already in place. But some other town residents NPR interviewed feared that building a U.S. base here would backfire and provoke the Russians. Most said they were too afraid to be recorded or give their names.
No, na pewno. Słucha pan, no.
One woman told me, it will take about an hour for the Russians to come and destroy everything. Poland will be wiped out. Can a few thousand American soldiers defend us from that? American officials also appear to have reservations about the proposed base. Before meeting with his Polish counterpart last week, U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis told reporters it is important to figure out what works best for NATO unity and security, not just the U.S.-Polish relationship. Retired Lieutenant General Ben Hodges is with the Center for European Policy Analysis, and until a year ago, commanded the U.S. Army in Europe. He says there are already 4,000 U.S. troops in Poland on any given day.
The strategic effect of U.S. commitment, I think, is already being achieved. And it's there in meaningful ways at a high level of readiness that doesn't give the Russians an excuse to go into Belarus, for example.
Officials in Belarus, which is also a Polish neighbor, have suggested they may allow the Russians to establish a base there if the Americans do so in Poland. Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. 10 minutes before 9 now, and you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. So if you're about to get the turkey ready, you might want to check this out. The latest article on wiscontext.org is an item from Kaiser Health News, which takes a look at the current salmonella outbreak in Turkey. There's information about how the outbreak relates to proper food handling and about efforts to regulate the pathogen. There are also some tasty articles on cranberries and maple syrup. Check it out at wiscontext.org.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Kenosha Unified School District is looking to hire substitute special education support professionals. For more information, visit kusd.edu/employment.
Diverse angles, it's voices that matter. It's the context you need to really understand. Start your day fully awake with Morning Edition. Listen every day.
And you are listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. In sports, the Milwaukee Bucks beat the Portland Trail Blazers last night 143-100. And in college basketball, number 25 Wisconsin hosts Oklahoma today at 12:30, having beaten the Stanford Cardinal. Apparently there's only one, 62-46 in Battle for Atlantis in the Bahamas. Partly to mostly cloudy today, the northern half of the state might see some patchy freezing drizzle or snow flurries. Breezy, highs in the mid-30s. Friday and Saturday more or less like that, but then some snow moving into the state on Sunday, possibly mixed with rain, and some areas could see up to 6 inches of snow. Highs in the mid-30s to mid-40s on Sunday.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. A few weeks ago, we asked you to share with us what it is about America that you're most thankful for. And you did share. We received over 1,000 responses, all very thoughtful, wholehearted, earnest. We gave your responses to our friend, Kwame Alexander, who is a pro at stitching together community poems. And he is in the studio with me. Hi, Kwame. Happy Thanksgiving.
Hello, my friend. I'm excited to be here.
All right. So you had to sort through all these submissions. What stood out to you?
I mean, the number of people who talked about libraries.
Really?
Yeah, and how they give public opportunities to improve our lives. It was amazing. Huh. Jody L.O. of Duluth, Minnesota wrote, "I am grateful for libraries, those sacred places to share knowledge and creativity." Jeff Milo of Ferndale, Michigan, he called them 21st century community centers where people can do so much to improve their lives, like meet with collaborators or learn a new skill.
I love it. I love that libraries are making a comeback.
People love them. I mean, it was like the poets came out of the woodwork for this challenge, which really made it difficult to choose which lines from which poems to include, because honestly, they all could stand on their own.
All right, so let's get a sense of that. And you've got one you're going to read from Rosemary Bogan, is that right?
Yes, she's from Helena, Alabama. "Because America is wide and vast, beautiful and messy, kind and harsh, limitless and barren, diverse and stuck, free and foiled, whole and broken, light and dark, I give thanks."
Wow, Rosemary, well done.
Yeah.
So we want to give a special shout out to teachers because, I mean, so many teachers wrote in with responses. And we even had some teachers who got their entire class to write gratitude poems, right?
Right. Like Miss Gerke of Louisville, Kentucky. Teachers rock.
Go, Miss Gerke. So let's move on to the main event. You took all these individual entries, and as you do, you made a beautiful holistic thing, a beautiful poem from all of them. So we're going to read this together?
We are.
Okay, let's do this. And a reminder, these are your thoughts on what it is about America that you're most thankful for. All right, let's read it. "The sun rising behind farmhouses in the Midwest, the clear mountain rivers in Montana. I hope we have the wisdom to treasure all of it.
A glimmer of dawn, first flickers in Maine.
For the mountains, magnificent weathered beacons of topographical wonder.
Tango gracias, I can speak my mind, y no hay consecuencia graves when I do so.
I won't lie, I struggled with this question. With all the fighting, hate, and violence, it's been difficult to remember to be thankful. However, when I read stories of people who stand up and speak out for justice and truth, I become immensely grateful and proud of America.
Freedom to whisper against kings, My grandmother who carried her green card in the broken tattoos on her back. I am thankful that other people are still trying to come here. I am thankful for the vastness of our borders and the beauty of our natural lands.
Sunshine streaming softly while we sip our morning coffee. But across the oceans, our troops fight, ensuring that we keep our rights to give us a land of the free. For the first responders, for hope.
I am thankful for America's history, warts and all, our past full of light and dark. Read the history of heroes and villains. See our country for what it is.
Free press and free speech to speak out against injustices in our country.
For family, for places to walk safely, places to paddle, arcades of trees, varied, inexpensive food, tools and workplaces, longtime friends who listen, tennis courts.
Indoor plumbing.
To worship whoever we want, to say whatever we want, to go wherever we want.
For the public libraries, they raise up voices whom others attempt to silence.
For diversity, for differences. My son is transgender, and I am grateful for those who treat her with respect and kindness.
For Cape May, for parties on the 4th of July, for anarchist coffee shops, for church-run thrift stores, hole-in-the-wall barbecue joints, Lake Michigan, Vinny's Pizzeria in the 90s, beer delivery in a snowstorm.
For second, third, and fourth chances, for forgiveness.
I am thankful that my hybrid existence, hinted by my brown skin and slanted eyes, can make sense in America.
For many spectacular parks in our nation, from the huge and awe-inspiring Grand Canyon to the tiny neighborhood park with the small playground and the pretty benches painted by local artists.
I am grateful that America can change, too. For the millions who take to the streets, challenge authority, insist on change, demand justice, resist evil, tell their stories.
Wrought through division, sustained by freedom's hope, seeking reunion, I am thankful for America most of the time.
America lets me connect and play videos with the world. America allows me to play basketball. America gives me a good education.
Thank you, America, for the mom and pop shops and rest stops, for the back roads and the beaten paths, for the love that greets me when I come home, for the dream to become, the dream to make better or different, the dream to inspire, the dream of something on the other side of whatever is facing us in the moment. For you.
Wow. That was awesome.
It's pretty stunning, right?
It's pretty stunning.
We did it.
We did it. Everyone out there did it. Thank you so much to all of you for contributing to this poem. It was a broader community effort. And thanks, Kwame, for making it what it was. We appreciate you.
Hey, I don't know about you, Rachel, but I'm about to get stuffed.
Yeah, it's that time, isn't it? Kwame Alexander, New York Times bestselling author of Swing. It's a novel about baseball, jazz, and social justice. Happy Thanksgiving, my friend.
Same to you, Rachel.
This Thanksgiving week marks the anniversary of one of history's most meaningful speeches. In November 1863, President Abraham Lincoln visited Gettysburg, Pennsylvania.
It was during the Civil War. Union forces had defeated Confederates at Gettysburg, and Lincoln was dedicating a cemetery for the battle's dead.
In a little over 2 minutes, he delivered a message to the crowd in their top hats.
It was also a message to later generations. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal.
Those words are so familiar, it's possible to miss what Lincoln really said. The war was being fought over slavery, the idea that not everyone should be equal. Lincoln affirmed the very purpose of the country is equality, as the Declaration of Independence says.
The president referred to the soldiers buried near him. We here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And join us at 3 for more of the day's news on BBC NewsHour, followed by All Things Considered at 4 with your host, Brady Carlson. It's a minute before 9. Stay with us. News from NPR and WPR in just a moment.
Support for WPR comes from Wild Birds Unlimited Madison, announcing an anniversary event featuring seed cylinders, heated bird baths, and hopper feeders and trays. WBUMadison.com. Discover a refuge in your own backyard.
Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, featuring Kenosha County-based Riverwood Produce. Best known for its springtime asparagus, Riverwood this Saturday will be offering carrots, Brussels sprouts, celery root, and other root vegetables. Winter Harbor Market is open at the Rhodey from 10 until 2. You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha.